W-E-T-E-N-P-C.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Nope. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. It's Thursday and this is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Tomorrow, we're going to go beyond the thin blue line. We're going to talk about phantoms and fingerprints with a CSI crime scene investigator who has had a chance to talk with other law enforcement officials and has collected a myriad of fascinating paranormal encounters and stories. We'll hear about those tomorrow on the show, plus a brand new theater of the mind. Today, we're going to go to Carolinas. Cursed in the Carolinas, Stories of the Damned is a new book that's coming out August 15th by Patty Wilson. And fascinating topic, fascinating title of the book. Patty Wilson was born here in the United States, lives in central Pennsylvania with her three sons. She's been a writer for 30 years. And has around 19 books to her credit. She's written about diverse subjects, including Pennsylvania, West Virginia, North Carolina history, folklore, and the paranormal. She's here with us this evening to talk about the brand new book. Patty, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
What a fascinating topic, Cursed in the Carolinas. Boy, did that jump out at me when we were going through the lists of upcoming books. And I knew this was something we had to cover on the show. Let me get a little bit of your background now. I mean, you've certainly been around historic sites. You were working for tours in Gettysburg for quite a while. Are you fascinated more with the history or the paranormal aspect of these locations?
Well, a little bit of both. And I have to be in truth in lending. My association with the ghosts of Gettysburg is as a writer and storyteller with Mark Nesbitt. Most of my history studying has been in central Pennsylvania because I'm fascinated with the French and Indian and colonial period, and I've lived in Old Bedford Village, which is a living history museum, and for a year and a half, and did storytelling there and stuff like that. But I'm totally fascinated with every facet of history, so I love that part of it. And you cannot divorce history and the paranormal from each other because that's what makes sense of it all.
Well, that's an interesting statement. Well, talk to me about your own experiences. Did you have paranormal experiences growing up, or was this something that only happened once you started to unfold the annals of time and history in your research?
Well, if you go back to my very early books, I do say that I'm as psychic as a box of rocks, and I said that because I didn't want anybody to know I was sensitive. I was brought up by a mother who was a domestic missionary in a very fundamentalist church, and my grandma could see stuff and hear stuff, and we had family stories forever. And I was always told, you don't tell anyone. So for the longest time, I didn't tell anyone. And then accidentally, we were at a site, Mark Nesbitt and myself and his wife, Carol, and I whispered something to Carol because the woman that they had brought to the site as a psychic was totally off the mark. And Carol looked at me in shock, and she said, you can hear him. And I kind of shrugged and said, no, not really. She said, oh, no, you can hear him. So Mark outed me on NPR and kind of took me down a different path than I had ever intended. So I'd had paranormal experiences my whole life, and the paranormal was woven into my universe, but I didn't want to admit it at the beginning.
Now, you said you could hear. Are you able to see and hear spirits, or is it just something that if you're in the right place at the right time, you can pick up on things? See, that's the way I kind of work. I wouldn't say I'm sensitive, and I'm usually as psychic as a box of rocks myself. But you get into the right place, and you kind of become one with the location and the history of it. Is that how it works for you?
Sometimes. It's different in different locations and with different spirits. And I don't know if it's because the way they can connect with me is different. I can sometimes physically with my eyes see them. More often in my mind's eye, if I close my eyes, I can begin to tell what I'm seeing in my head. Sometimes I call it the knowing, when you just know you know, but you can't explain how you know it. It's just suddenly there, kind of like the download on a computer. You hit a button and boom, it's all there. And I'll be in a site and working, and all of a sudden I'll just start to freeze and I'll go, wait. And then it's like, oh my God, this is what I'm getting told. And then other times I hear. And sometimes I can do all three in the same evening, in the same event. Sometimes I think it has more to do with the amount of energy and how they think they need to communicate with us. And I've noticed that part of it, the doing the multiple different things during an evening, the most when I've done readings, which I do not do for money and which I do not do for fun. If I do a reading for somebody, it's always need-based. They're struggling, they're emotional about something, or there's some unresolved issue that requires their attention. And so I'll do it for those reasons only.
Why do these spirits seem to hang around such historic locations like this, Patty? I mean, you would think that they would want to go on to whatever is next, but they linger for hundreds and in some cases thousands of years in these horrific locations that were just filled with death. Why do you think they're still there?
Well, I think there's a multitude of reasons. I think in some instances where there's not a historically painful event, it's because they liked the place and it means something to them. When it's historically significant, like Gettysburg or a battlefield anyplace else, a lot of times it's the trauma. My background is in psychology, and you can very clearly see when you're talking to these spirits, their trauma. You can't get them past that moment. You can't get them past the event. For example, there's a bridge called Burnside's Bridge, and it's in at a battlefield from Civil War. And every time you go to this bridge, I see the same young man. He has dark hair, and on the one side you can see the stubble and what have you of beard, but on the other side there's no jaw. He's just this open wound, and his eyes are so pleading. And I have stood easily a dozen times on this bridge and tried to explain to him that he can go. He doesn't have to stay here. He doesn't have to suffer because there's no physical body. He shouldn't be experiencing the pain, but the emotional and psychological pain of this event has rendered him frozen in time, so to speak, and he's not able to get that connection that time has passed. I don't have to be here. Other times you can make sense of that with people. And I remember being in Gettysburg with Mark, and we were at the engine house, and we were talking to this man, and he said, I don't understand why you can talk to me and other people don't. And I said, well, have you noticed our clothes are different? And I started rationalizing with him. And he goes, so I'm dead. And I'm like, yes, for a long time. And he goes, oh, then I understand what I should do. And he was just gone. So some of them are conscious enough mentally to make that jump, and some of them aren't. And those who aren't, I think they're stuck. They're stuck because their perception is that they're stuck. And so I believe very much that perception is reality, whether it's in the psychological realm, again, my background being in psychology, so whatever a person believes is what they live with, or in the spiritual realm, because again, I have seen it over and over, people believing that they can't leave a site or telling me things like, I murdered people here, I can't go. And then we will start to rationalize, no, you didn't murder, you were a soldier in a battle, in the heat of a battle. And then I'll try to find ways to make them understand that there's a difference.
Do they ever relate to you? Do they see the other dead walking among the area, or are they kind of isolated and just there?
It depends on the person and the situation. Sometimes they are able to respond to others that are around them, and particularly if they're from the same time period. But then there's other times when they don't. And I kind of like the analogy of it, thinking of it as a book. So this person who's dead is on page 127, which is maybe the Civil War. And if he goes forward, that he doesn't exist because he died on page 127. So he doesn't see these people. But we can still see him because we can read further into the book. And then if you go to page 189, there might be a lady who lived in the house and died of a heart attack. She doesn't see the guy on page 127 because he didn't exist in her world. So that perception thing still comes into play. It is rare. There are cases. I know at Mark Nesbitt's business, there's a spirit there by the name of Mrs. Kitzmiller, who owned the property probably the longest of anybody. Now, Mrs. Kitzmiller is very conscious of what's going on in this world today, very opinionated, and she's more than willing to say it on EVP. And she's aware of the spirits that are there that have died in that house, and she will talk about them. But that's the exception, not the rule.
That's interesting, because that's a lot of how I've described what I believe is going on in Haunting as well, as though it's pages in a book. They're all in the same location, you know, from start to finish, and every page is its own story. And sometimes those stories can bleed through and sometimes they can't. So it's really interesting to me to hear somebody else kind of mirroring that thought process. When they're battlefields and the people died together, do many of them hang in clusters together, or again, do they seem like wandering souls?
It's going to be a different. Back to Mark and Carol's. There's a soldier there on the first floor. His name is Hank. He died at some point in that battle. I don't know when, but he stays there alone because he was a sentry and he believes he's still on guard duty. However, upstairs there's three Georgians, and we know that they're there, and we know that the Georgians actually had possession of the building, and those three men seem to stay together. And so I think it has a lot to do with maybe if you had a connection in this life, and if maybe you died together in some instances. I've seen both on battlefields. I've seen people that just kind of go along all by themselves. I remember down in Virginia and one of the battlefields near the wilderness. There's like five battlefields down in that area. And Mark took me there, and I didn't know where we were going. And he just said, describe what you see. And I remember being breathless because I had as my benchmark the Battle of Gettysburg. It's the worst battle that anybody could live through. But these battles that I was seeing were so much worse. I remember starting to cry and tell him, oh, my God, it's raining, and they're stepping people into the mud, and they're stealing the canteens from these other people that are dying because the dying don't need the water, and all of this. And Mark has a great poker face. He didn't say boo to me about it. And then there was this one boy who sat under a tree, and he was singing the Yellow Rose of Texas. And I just sort of stopped and listened. And we actually have some EVP of him singing. And all these other people were around him, but all he wanted to talk about is, could he leave now? Because that's where his mom and dad were going to settle after the battle. And they had written to him that, you know, we're moving to Texas, and we will tell you where to come when you get free of all of this. And he was still waiting to get free.
Do they have any concept of how long they've been there? I mean, you would think that, all right, it's been 100+ years they've been in these locations. Do they ever talk about the relevance of time, or is it the Hollywoodized version that to them it's just moments, but to us it's been 150 years?
Again, it's a perception issue. Some of them, like Mrs. Kitzmiller, is very cognizant of time. She understands time has passed, and that maybe she can't give you the exact year, but she could definitely tell you a lot of things that have changed over time. Others, sometimes you have to point it out to them. I remember being at a battlefield, also it was in Virginia, and there's a country club that sits on this ground now, and they're having haunting issues, and we had to get a calendar and show the boy the calendar and say, can you see the numbers? Can you read? And he's like, yes, I can read. And then when we showed him the numbers, he's like, you're not lying. It's really true. And I'm like, no, I'm not lying, sweetheart. It's true. A long time has gone by. You don't have to be here anymore. And then at that point started to explain to him that he could cross over to be with his loved ones. And at that point he began to consider maybe I wasn't crazy, because up to that point he had thought I was the one who was nuts, because he'd been there a long time, but he didn't understand how long.
Do you ever find yourself in positions there while you're walking among the dead that you will encounter otherworldly presence, dark presences, things that don't seem to have ever been human in nature, walking among the dead as well?
Oh, my, yes. Well, I have encountered elementals, and I have encountered dark things that I would consider, I'm a religious person, so I would consider demonic in nature. They are complete negatives. They're blackness and pain and just negative personified. And usually they bring with them for the living sadness or fear or pain. And, you know, when those things happen, if possible, I will dispatch what I can and go to get help if I'm not able to do it on my own.
Do the dark entities interfere at all with the spirits of these lost soldiers or lost people at these locations at all? Do they seem to be, you know, we always hear these stories of something's holding them back. Do you ever fear that it is these elementals or demons, whatever term fits?
I don't think the demons hold them back, but I think they use the same energies. And so these are great places for them to come to attach, because there's an openness to people when they're scared and when they're seeking the paranormal that allows them to kind of get their foot through the door. And I think that's why they come. I don't think that they themselves hold these other spirits back. Those spirits are held back by their own perceptions and their own private pains. But I do believe that the demons and the negative energies use that same feeding ground, and they're looking for fertile soil. And a lot of times people that are coming to these places, either because they're afraid or because they're immensely curious and they make mistakes of opening up doors they shouldn't have, they can get these things attached to them. And once they get a foothold, they can become a really troublesome issue in their lives.
Do you ever come across these spirits that have been there for so long that they are just filled with anger and rage? And what's it like when you're confronted by those?
I have been a few places where the spirits have been extremely angry. And sometimes I will walk away because there's no reasoning with them. And I'll just say, there's nothing I can do for you. I can't deal with you because you won't listen. Other times you almost feel like psychically they're pummeling you, beating you down. And for your own sense of safety and protection, you have to go out of that area. I will often say to them, which is puzzling to them, it stops them most of the time. And I will say, I will just pray for you. And when I say that like it's like somebody slapped them in the face. Some of them will rage, I don't need your prayers, God's not real. And then others will stop and just sort of freeze, like it just dawned on them that, you know, somebody's showing compassion, maybe the first somebody in quite a while. So it depends on the particular entity. But if they're not demonic, I will say to them, I will pray for you. And sometimes that's enough to at least rock them back on their heels and they'll back up.
Well, let's start to talk about the new book, Cursed in the Carolinas. What drew you to this aspect of history and opening up to discuss this?
Well, there were several things that interested me about it. The first thing you should know is that this is a book in a series of books. Mark and I wrote Cursed in Pennsylvania. And when I saw that the same publishing house was going to do Cursed in the Carolinas, I kind of stuck my hand up and went, ooh, please let me do it. And they're like, why? You live in Pennsylvania. And the short answer of it is that I spent about 4 or 5 years in North Carolina, not living there, but traveling back and forth, working with the governor's office and the state historian, documenting history and hauntings in the state, and also working with Ryan Research Center for 2 years on learning what people in the ghost hunting field do, because, you know, they do psychical research and they wanted to know what do people like myself do. And so I have a great love and respect for their history, and boy, did I know stories. And so I'm like, oh, wait, please let me try. And they're like, well, make an outline and see what we can do. And when I made the outline, they obviously liked it enough that they decided it was worth their time, and so we began to put together the book.
Well, talk to me about the idea of cursed to begin with. When you refer to a cursed Pennsylvania or cursed Carolinas, what exactly is your definition? Is this just something where a lot of bad things have happened, so hence we call it cursed, or are they locations where curses have been known to have been put upon these areas or these people?
Well, I think when I started, I thought, I'm from Pennsylvania, and we have the Brockers and the witches and all that stuff that came from the Amish and what have you. So I thought curses were like the evil eye, you know, I curse you. And they sometimes are. But I came to realize that there are places that are cursed. There are people who are cursed. There are people who curse themselves. And that all of these things come into play depending on the place. And as I was working through the first book, I was amazed at the amount of ways people can be cursed. And then so when I got to this book, I kind of understood it a little bit better. And I write about that in the opening to the book, about my journey from, you know, I curse you to, oh my gosh, your actions cursed you, your evil part cursed you, those sort of things, or history cursed you, or different ways of being cursed.
And now, how many of the cursed books have you been a part of?
I have worked on two. I wrote Cursed in the Carolinas by myself. And Mark and I wrote Cursed in Pennsylvania together. And I know Mark's working on, I believe it's Cursed in Virginia.
Well, let's talk about the Cursed in Pennsylvania, since we've been talking about Gettysburg and all that area anyway, and then leap into the Carolinas for the new one. Tell me about some of the more fascinating curses and stories that you have in that book.
Well, I know Mark had told a story in the book that is really interesting about the Devil's Den area. And everybody knows about, of course, the battle then what happened there. But what people don't realize is that that area was already cursed by another battle. There was a huge Native American battle down there. And it was every bit as big and as bad as the battle that we think of as the Battle of Gettysburg, because it was a Native American battle. There were literally almost as many arrowheads found as there are mini balls and bullets and what have you. So it was really interesting to me when I was reading through that to find out that that this was a place that was cursed. It seemed to have battles over and over again.
Why would you think that, though? I mean, why would a piece of land seem to have such negativity attached to it that it would just continually be the site of bloodbaths and carnage like that?
I honestly don't know what it is that draws negativity to it. Is it because of the ley lines, the way it looks? I don't know. I honestly don't know the answer to that. But I would say that there are places like that. I know of at least a half a dozen such places. And if I were talking about another story from the book, I would say the story of Reuben Rock is by far my favorite story out of the book. In a lot of ways, because it's documentable. It happened during World War II. And there's just no question whatsoever that this story is a true story. It was in the newspapers of the time. If I might, I will share it with you.
Yes, please. We'd love to hear it.
Okay. Reuben Rock was a young soldier who married his sweetheart. Her name was Luella, and went to war during World War II. He was stationed in South Africa, which was where Rommel was, and there was a lot of mustard gas used and what have you. It damaged his lungs significantly, and when he was sent home, he was sent home as an invalid. He had just begun to build a little house before he had been shipped out, and so he had the shell of a house. When he came back home, he tried to work on building the house and take up his life with Luella, but his illness was so severe that it didn't take long for them to realize he wasn't going to make it. He managed to finish one room, and Luella was dirt poor, trying to subsist, if you would, on whatever she could earn doing laundry, cleaning houses, what have you, and his little stipend and family charity. Well, as Reuben's days near their end, he made her promise that she would not bury him in his military uniform because he truly believed that the gassing would not have happened had his military leaders done something differently. He blamed the military. Luella solemnly swears she will not do this. But then when Reuben dies, she has no money to pay for the funeral. So the local VFW comes up and says, hey, we will pay for everything for Reuben. And that's not a problem, but you got to bury him in his uniform. And you can imagine the heart tug this must have been for this young woman to have lost her husband in all of this, and now to have to break her last promise. But she has no choice, so she buries him in his uniform. And within a day or so, her sister's staying with her, and they come running down to her mom and dad's house saying, Reuben's haunting the place. Reuben's haunting the place. They told crazy stories of seeing Reuben looking in the windows at night, of seeing him sitting on top of the roof of the little house, of him stomping around in the second floor that was unfinished. And at first, of course, her mom and dad thought that this was Luella's imagination because she felt guilty. So they sent other siblings down. And sure enough, everybody kept coming back with the same story. He was haunting and he's very angry. He's very upset. Luella starts to lose weight. She starts to become very depressed. And eventually her mother gets so concerned. She goes down and she gets Luella and she says, enough is enough. You can't stay here. You're coming home. And when she's at the house with her mother, she tells a story about a little box, a metal box that Reuben brought back from South Africa. And it had some witchy things in it, she said, voodoo pieces. And her mother, as a good Christian lady, decides this box is evil. It must be destroyed. So she sends one of the boys down. He finds the box where Luella said it was and brings it back. They open it up, and there's a fetish. And attached to it is a little picture in a picture frame, and it's a picture of Luella. Her mother sees it and thinks this is Reuben's way of cursing Luella and making her sick. So she tears the fetish off and throws it in the fire in the kitchen cook stove and throws the picture down on the table. Now, this is what the newspaper said. The newspaper said that the photograph undulated across the table and crawled toward Luella. That was what was in the newspaper at the time.
Yikes.
And that, of course, that was confirmation to all of them that this is true, that you know, he was messing with stuff he shouldn't have been messing with, and he cursed his wife. So they got a powwow doctor, a local man who was kind of half minister, half kind of folk medicine, and his name was Mr. Ferguson. And Mr. Ferguson came down from Everett to East Freedom, which is about a 45-minute drive, and talked to the family and said, yep, I know exactly what's wrong. Now, we're not talking the 1700s or 1800s. We're talking the late 1930s, early 40s.
Okay.
He goes to the cemetery early on a frosty morning, and along with Luella's brothers and dad and the local sheriff, they dig up Reuben's body. He takes the uniform off of Reuben, lays the corpse on a white sheet, salts the corpse down, says prayers over it, wraps the sheet around it, and they rebury Reuben. The curse is over.
That is freaky. And especially that it was reported and people were witnessing this and seeing it unfold. And again, this wasn't just, you know, the Dark Ages. These were intelligent people that were watching this kind of unfurl. Now, you had mentioned the term fetish a few times, and I'm sure there's quite a few of our listeners that don't understand what that means in relation to this type of story. Can you explain that to us?
Sure. A fetish in this type of story would be little objects that would be imbued with magical or mystical powers. Often you'll see like a chicken's, a rooster's claw, maybe some feathers, things like that. And they're bound together, and then incantations and possibly blood or what have you is poured over them. And this is believed to imbue them with a special power, whether it's a power for good or power for evil. And so Luella Dively's mom believed that Reuben had put a curse on her because he made her promise, and then when she broke her promise, the curse was activated.
Wow, that's really bizarre. All right, let's jump into more of the newer stories in the Carolinas. We'll do that. We have to take a quick break. I want to mention, if you're around the Twin Cities this weekend, please come on out and see me. I'm going to be at the Edge Life Holistic Expo, the Maple Grove Holistic Expo, presented by Edge Life Expos and Events this Saturday, July 29th, from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m., only $5 admission. It's at the Maple Grove Community Center, 12951 Weaver Lake Road in Maple Grove. John DeSalvo will be there. I'll be on hand as well as, I think, about 40 different types of exhibitors, from the holistic to messengers, shamans, mystics. You want to see it, you will find it here. It is an amazing and very fun one-day event. You can find more information at edgelife.net. That's edgelife.net. We'll be back with more right after this.
Beyond the Darkness.
We're back on the Best in Paranormal Talk Radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. Today, Cursed in the Carolinas. Stories of the Damned. Patty Wilson, our guest. Let's get to it. We've been teasing them for the first half an hour of the show. Let's get into Carolinas and some of the stories that you put together for this book, Patty.
Okay. I guess we could start at the beginning. I tried to do some stories that were historically significant. Those stories I found to be really interesting. Things like Blackbeard's Curse. You could not do the Carolinas and not talk about Blackbeard. Of course, he was one of the most famous pirates of all time, and we all know his brutality. But the thing that I found interesting about it was that it was true. He really was the kind of person who would just murder his best friend for no reason at all. He would be a serial killer today. So you could easily see, you know, how he could be cursed. And there's a wonderful, I guess, in being respective, story of him murdering one of his best friends. He had a mistress, and the man was at a party with the mistress and Blackbeard. He thought that this, Blackbeard thought that this woman was being too flirty and that this man was being too receptive. So he met them on the staircase and cut the guy's head off right there, rolled over to his mistress's feet. I'm sure she screamed, and at that point he cut off her head.
Yikes.
So he had no compunctions whatsoever. Killing people was second nature to this man. He really was as brutal and bloody as we think he is. And so maybe he didn't have the heads of all of his ex-wives in a closet, as in the story of Blackbeard's heads, but most certainly he was a very brutal man. And there is a place called Titch's Hole, which Edward Titch was actually Blackbeard's real name, and people see his ship forever sailing out of there, as though he's cursed to never cross over into the other side because of his evil acts. And it is an amazing story when you read about it, all the things he did and how he came to be where he was. And then when he died, he was actually killed by the British government. And the officer who killed him cut his head off and for weeks had it on a pike at the head of the ship, so everybody could see that he was the one who killed Blackbeard.
Now, how long was Blackbeard's reign of terror? Was it a short span, or was it actually quite long?
It was actually fairly long, comparatively. I'd say about a decade and a half to 2 decades.
And nobody really rose up to just stop this guy? I mean, if he was that villainous, you would think that, or I guess maybe it's one of those legends like the Batman, right? He's just so legendary and frightful, people refuse to even think about confronting him.
Well, he used fear really well. First of all, he was a privateer, which was basically there was the French and the British were at war. This was British territory. And so the British would pay British ships to become pirates and raid the French ships. The French did the same in reverse. So he actually grew up as a cabin boy on a British ship that was a privateer. And when he got old enough, he killed his commander and stole his ship and became the commander of the ship. So he started out as a teenager killing. And, you know, there was a lot more brutal times, so a lot of people killed. But then he realized that fear was a great motivator. And so the stories about him having fire coming around his face, what he did is he would take cannon fuse and weave it through his beard and light it. And so he had to look ferocious with this, you know, fire spouting around his face. It was terrifying. And anybody who bucked him, he killed them or tortured them. So very quickly it became well known that you did not buck this guy. This guy was crazy. And then he stole a sloop, which was called, which you could call the Queen Anne's Revenge. The Queen Anne was his original ship he sailed on. And so this one was his revenge. He was now doing what he wanted his way. And then he had a fleet of ships that he stole. And so he was quite a powerful figure in that time period on the Atlantic Ocean. And they robbed and pillaged and killed. And they had places such as the city of Bath, which was a port town, where they were well received because they made a lot of money off of Blackbeard and his men. And so he had his own cadre of places he could go where he was safe. And the British government wanted him in the worst of ways because he was no longer stealing from the French and, you know, keeping a part of the booty and giving the rest to the British government. Now he was stealing from the British, and he was keeping it all for himself. So that's what put him on the bad side of the British government, and he enjoyed it immensely. He traveled up and down from, you know, Jamaica all the way to New England, and he had no compunctions in killing anybody, anywhere, anytime.
You always hear of these pirate treasure curses that are out there. Are there any associated with Blackbeard?
There are some stories about such things, that he murdered people and poured their blood over his treasures to keep them safe. That's a very old story. And you hear them from time to time in different places. But what I always thought was really interesting was not so much the people he killed, but the fact that that he apparently cursed himself by his own actions to never be allowed to completely die.
Yeah, that's just a bizarre tale. And with as popular as the Pirates movies have been and all of these different histories, that's a great one to kick off with. All right, I'm sorry.
That was okay. It is, and then there's other historic pieces. Aaron Burr, I talk about Aaron Burr's curse.
Please, share it.
Aaron Burr was our vice president under Thomas Jefferson, and believe it or not, they hated each other. Our political system was very different, and Burr was one of the smartest lawyers you could possibly imagine, but he always had a knack for doing things wrong, going too far. He would get right to the pinnacle of success and then totally screw it up. He would shoot himself in the foot, so to speak. He got on the wrong side of Jefferson and decided that he was going to create his own country. So he and a guy by the name of Leonard Hassett from West Virginia decided they were going to steal what we now call Texas, which was just a Western territory, out from under the United States. So Burr kind of fakes some records and changes some documents and what have you, and tries to twist things up so that Jefferson can't buy that parcel of land. It's huge, thousands upon thousands of acres of land, so they can start their own country with their own military and do things their own way. This is treason. This is sedition. This has to stop. He gets caught and almost goes to jail for this. Of course, we all know the story of him shooting Hamilton and almost going to jail for that. And he seems to always just skirt right on the edge of it. But then we come to what I believe was his worst curse. He had a daughter named Theodosia. Theodosia was gorgeous, and he had raised her alone because her mother died at birth, right after she was born. And interestingly enough, though, Burr was not a man of his times in some respects. He truly believed that all women were very, very intelligent. They had a right to a complete education. He undertook to educate his daughter, Shirup, as any man would have educated his oldest son. So she was able to write fluently. She was very talented. And he would challenge her in politics and all these different venues. She would eventually marry the man who would become the governor of South Carolina. And by now, Burr has alienated himself from the United States, and he is living abroad in France. And through a series of secret letters, he and his daughter, Theodosia, decide that they're going to meet, but they have to do it outside of the United States. So she goes to her husband and she says, "I want to see my dad one more time, please." And they come up with this scheme where she's going to say she's going to visit friends, get on a ship, and then be passed on to another ship where they're going to go out to international waters. Her dad's going to be on another ship, meet them, and they'll have a couple weeks to talk, and then she'll come back. And hopefully the people of South Carolina will never know that she had gone to see her father. That's the plan. And it seems like it's going to work. She gets on board the ship, and they start out where they're going, and then everything goes haywire. Before she gets anywhere near international water, the ship is waylaid by pirates. She is taken captive, and the last thing that is absolutely known is that she was taken captive and put aground on an island with some of the pirates watching over her. The guy who was the head of the pirates, he didn't know who she was, but he knew she was rich. She was worth money. She could be ransomed back. And something about her and the way she carried herself and the way she spoke intrigued him. So rather than kill her and take the jewelry, which is what he had done with all the other passengers, he put her aground on this island, deciding he was going to try to find out more about who she was and unfortunately probably hurt her, rape her. So the story goes that she laid all night on the beach watching these pirates drinking and what have you. And when they finally passed out, she realized that she was never going to be able to get home. And she refused the indignity of being raped. So in order to stop that, she quietly stood up and walked to the water's edge, stepped into the water, and drowned herself. When the pirate captain came back the next day, he found a scene of all these guys drunk. None of them were, you know, paying attention to business. And they could see the young woman's footprints going out into the surf. And so it was assumed she had committed suicide rather than be violated. This was indeed Aaron Burr's worst curse, because there was nothing in this world that he loved more than his daughter Theodosia. She is seen from time to time on this island walking along the surf and out into the ocean. And I think her father's actions, his imprudence and his desire to become a very rich and famous man, cursed his daughter to death.
God, that's heartbreaking. Very strange.
And it's a sad story. And if you ever get a chance to read about Theodosia, she's an amazing woman.
Well, and Burr and Hamilton had a battle out over a woman, wasn't it? The same woman that they both were in love with and ended up having a duel?
Ostensibly, that was probably the straw that broke the camel's back. But they were also bitter, bitter political rivals. And it goes all the way back to a deal where Hamilton had thought he had gotten the better of Burr, and Burr tricked him and lied to him and stole from him. And so there was a lot of bad blood between them long before the young lady came into question.
All right, boy, that is a heartbreaker. Do you have, are there really scary curses? You know, we heard of the curse of Tutankhamun and some of these other curses where people seem to just die in droves, according to what the history is. Is there anything like that that seems to stain Pennsylvania or Carolina?
Carolinas. I can't tell you that I know of any curses where anybody who goes to this place, they're going to die or anything like that. But what I can tell you is there are some kind of scary curses. In the Carolinas book, I did one story that's called I Could Slap the Life Out of Her. And it's based on a plantation down there that was a slave plantation. And the story goes that there was an old woman who was a servant in the house. She was an African-American woman, and she was very beloved by the family. And when she got very old and sick, rather than sell her, do away with her, what have you. The slave master decided that he was going to put her in a little cabin near the house and have one of the other younger slaves, a woman by the name of Sissy, come in out of the fields and take care of this old lady till she passed away, because she was very beloved. So Sissy is thrilled to come in and do this, and it's the least work she's probably ever done as a slave. The family has to go away for some time, and so the slave owner leaves everything in the plantation manager's hands. And every day, all Sissy has to do is cook for the lady, make sure she gets to the bathroom, that stuff. But she's lazy, and she's mean, and she's spiteful. And she doesn't really like having to serve this old woman. She doesn't understand why she should have to do this. This is her time to be young and pretty and flirt with the guys and all this stuff. And the old lady would sit there, and as friends would come by in the evenings, talk to her and stuff, she'd say, "I hate that girl, Sissy. I could just slap the life right out of her." And she'd tell them about whatever indignity, like she didn't feed me today, or she wouldn't go and get me water until 2 o'clock in the afternoon, or whatever it was that was wrong. And eventually, one day, the old lady passed away. Well, suddenly, Sissy realizes that she's got no reason to be in the house anymore. She's going to have to go back to the fields, and she's determined she's not going to do it. She's never going back there where she gets whipped and beat on and what have you. And so when plantation manager comes in that evening, she's wailing and screaming, "Oh no, she's died, she's died." She's putting on a good show of how grief-stricken she is. And he tells her, he's like, "You know, you're going to come back to the fields after the funeral tomorrow, but you can stay home until tomorrow's over, and then that's it." Well, the woman, Sissy, she puts on a good show at the funeral, and he's like, he tells her she's going to go back the next day, and she doesn't come back. And he doesn't really want to beat on him because he knows the slave owner is not a big guy for that. He's more of a "we'll work it out" kind of a fella, more of a pacifist. So for 2 more days, things go on like this, with Sissy locked up in her cabin and the manager getting very frustrated because he knows everybody else is watching him. If he lets her push him, they're all going to push him. And he can't have that. He can't do his job. So he makes up his mind on the fourth day that if she doesn't come out, he's going to drag her out and he's going to beat her in front of everybody, despite what the property owner thinks, because he's got to get order back. So he goes over to check on her and to tell her that this is it. This is what's going to happen. And when he gets there, there's no answer. And he's pounding on the door and she's still not answering. And finally, he says to one of the slaves that's with him, "Kick the door in." So they knock the door in, and there she lays on the ground, her face all beaten and battered. But the interesting thing is the door was barred from the inside, and there was no way for anyone to get out. And people came rushing in to look at the body, and one of the old ladies said, "She always said she could slap the life right out of her. I do believe that's what the old woman did." And Sissy was cursed to die because of her own actions.
Wow, another stunner. See, when you get into the idea of curses, it always fascinates me on what people's perceptions of a curse is. And you seem to be covering many different types of curses. How many of them that you find are curses that are placed on somebody by others, as opposed to kind of curses that they bring upon themselves, if you want to call it karmic justice or whatever? I mean, what's the difference in those two?
Well, I think some people by their own actions curse themselves, and then there's other people that just seem fate curses them in some way. We do a story in the book called Is Lynyrd Skynyrd's Band Suffering a Curse? And it talks about how as the band grew and got better, they always knew there was always this feeling in the original members that something was wrong, and how it just seemed like as soon as they would hit the apex, something bad would happen. Of course, the worst being the plane accident where two of the members were beheaded. And after that, the band never quite got its mojo back the way it had been originally. But, we talk about fate cursing people, and that's an example of fate cursing them, where their search for fame and what have you, even though it was a perfectly valid search and a lot of folks do it, somehow it just eluded them, and every time they got close to that apex, something slapped them down. And then you have, people who, like Sissy, were cursed by the old woman and maybe even killed by her. I don't know. But most curses, I think, come from people cursing themselves. They curse themselves with their actions, and you know, you could call it fate or karma or whatever you want to say, but somehow or another, it just seems like the fates align so that these people have to face and suffer for whatever it is that they have done.
That's bizarre. Yeah, you got to start. And I know we've talked about some different aspects of curses on our show in the past, and how easily I think sometimes you start getting into that quagmire of believing you're cursed, and that just starts to draw negativity and crap to you as well. Are there stories of people being able to break their curses and whatever seems to be, you know, cast upon them, they're eventually able to shake off and live a regular life again?
In Cursed in Pennsylvania, there's a story that actually fills the last two categories, both, of a young lady who was asked to go out by a young gentleman friend of hers at church, and she didn't like the man, and she kept putting him off and putting him off, and supposedly he cursed her. For about 7 years, her life was cursed. It just seemed like she would have fits, she would have spasms and go into catatonic states. And I have always thought, from a psychological perspective, that was most probably her mind playing the trick on her. Her father would try over and over to pay people to, you know, break the curse, ministers and priests and different people, and they could not ever get it done. Now, eventually he would find one man who, on the third attempt, seemed to, however it happened, however he managed it, to convince them that he had broken the curse. At that point, her life was resumed, and she did go ahead and live her life out. But of course, she did pay a price, because whether she was really cursed by her own beau or whether she cursed herself by believing she was cursed, she lost years of her life. She lost the happiness and the love of the young gentleman she wanted to marry. All these things were changed by her belief that she was cursed.
The idea of a curse and how they're placed upon people. I mean, it's always fascinating to me, right? Is somebody angry at you, casting aspersions on you? You said the fates might have cursed you, which again seems strange, right? Unless there's some kind of karmic backlash for other things you've done, it would seem like, why would you be brought to these points and then, you know, horrible fates would befall you. You look at how many of these celebrities fall under the 27 Club, all these musicians. And that, you know, that really does make you start to scratch your head and sit back and question things, because there is an inordinate amount of musicians who've all died by 27. Now, I understand that musicians live kind of a loose, crazy life filled with drugs and alcohol and stupid antics. But still, there's a lot of life between 17 and 30, a lot of years in there that people could drop dead. But 27 seems to be the most powerful. And, it makes you wonder if there is some kind of contractual agreement for fame at times. Is that a curse?
I think sometimes it is. I think sometimes when you have blind ambition of any sort, without any compunctions, without compassion, without, you know, recognizing that there should be harmony, that when you put yourself so far out of balance that you accidentally or inadvertently curse yourself. And if you look at these people who died, their pursuit of fame becomes the only reason that they live. And maybe that puts them out of karmic balance or spiritual balance, or however you want to say it. But most certainly it does seem that 27 is a bad number. If you make it past 27 as a young musician and a famous, you know, famous one at that, you're a very lucky person sometimes, because there's a huge amount of people who have died at the age of 27, and some of them very mysteriously, some of them not, you know, drugged. I've actually just read a story of a young man who wasn't a singer, and he wasn't into the drug scene more than normal and what have you. And he didn't really just die. He just disappeared. He just ceased to be. Nobody to this day knows what happened to the young gentleman. So, you know, it just seems like there are that pursuit of fame over all. And I think it's that way for a lot of people. If you look at people, whether it's a normal average person or a person who's famous, if you put one thing above everything else, you will find that your life is so far out of balance, you've cursed yourself.
That's an interesting aspect. So the idea is to learn how to balance all of your life, and then things won't get top heavy or maybe feel like they're collapsing in on you.
I think so. I believe so. I think that a lot of our illnesses, a lot of our spiritual illnesses, physical illnesses, all of that comes together. And it's because we're out of balance. We're out of balance either spiritually, psychically, emotionally, physically, you know, and you can look at it and say, you know, this, your gluttony cursed you to die of a heart attack. You could look at it, you know, in various ways. And I just think it's a really interesting perspective, because when you look at these stories and you break them down, most of the time, not always, but most of the time, these people had some degree of control and maybe even some degree of culpability for their curses.
Let's dip in. I know time's getting away from us here, but let's round out with a couple of your favorite stories from the New Carolina book as well. Give me one or two more before we say goodnight.
I would have to tell you that probably one of my favorite stories would be Lydia's Bridge. There's a story from North Carolina about a place that's it's a little bridge in the middle of nowhere. It's not a big, famous, fantastic thing. But the story is very much an old story. A young lady going to the prom, and after the prom is over, this is her best night ever. Her mom's made sure she had a beautiful dress. Her hair is perfect. She's got the right young man with her. And on the way home, he gets, and he's a little drunk, and it's raining and what have you, and he hits the bridge at a high rate of speed and kills her. And unfortunately for her, she ends up haunting that area. She gets in the back of cars, and people see her all the time. And in this instance, maybe it was Lydia's vanity. Maybe it was her hope or her pride, because the young man doesn't die, and the young man doesn't seem to care, but he doesn't die. And she is forever doomed to haunt this area. She will not let go, and she will not go away. And so I think that that's one of the sadder stories, because, you know, Lydia will always haunt her bridge.
Yeah, the idea of these kind of cursed loves. I know there's the story, and it's very Romeo and Juliet in Arkansas, and I think it's Pettit Jean Mountain is the name of it. Are you familiar with that story?
I am, yeah.
Can you, you probably know it better than I do. I had a chance to visit that and hear the story, but can you maybe relate that story to our listeners? That's a fascinating one.
Well, I don't know. I can't tell you guys all the details, but I do know that, you know, as you said, it's much of Romeo and Juliet story. They were trying, their young couple fell in love, families wanted to keep them apart, and, you know, they ran off and to the end of the night in the middle of the winter and froze to death or disappeared. They were never found.
Oh, okay. See, I thought that was, maybe I'm confusing, because there are so many of these kind of weird love curses that go on. I had heard that, and again, maybe again, it's from a different location that'll jump to your mind quicker than mine. She had been waiting for her love to return. He didn't, and she threw herself off the mountain and died, and he showed up shortly thereafter. He had been detained doing something and got to the meeting late and ended up taking his own life as well.
Maybe I have the story wrong, and I apologize if I did. There's a story in North Carolina of a place where the there's an updraft, and if you drop a piece of paper or even a hat or something, it'll float upward instead of down. And there's a similar story about that place, that supposedly this young couple leapt to their death rather than be kept apart. And she jumped first, and then when he realized that she had gone, when he got there, he did away with himself as well. So there are so many of those such stories.
Right, yeah, and you talk about a cursed life. I mean, that was just bad timing. That was horrific. Are there places that when you're doing this research and you hear about maybe that you haven't been to before, that you put yourself in there, can you feel it physically that there is really something different there? Or is it, do you think our perceptions, you know, psychology, is it because we go in with the preconceived notion of what occurred and the tragedies that befall certain locations? Or do you think there really is a kind of a temporal scar?
I think if you know about the story, you have to always assume that that perception and your imagination could take place. But there are places, I do believe, that are just simply cursed. I know of a place in Pennsylvania where I did not know the story when I first went there. And I remember sitting at this place and I would see a black shadow figure moving and I would say, oh my gosh, this is an awful place. This is an awful place. And then the family told me their story. And I am completely convinced that this place is cursed. Everybody that's ever lived there has never come to any good. They could have had a beautiful life. They buy this property and their whole life turns around. And it's interesting because it's the same series of events over and over. The family buys the place. The man suddenly gets very angry and hateful, begins to beat and abuse his wife and kids. And it's just that same story playing out generation after generation. And interestingly enough, you would think if I were a member of a family and I knew that three generations, four generations of the family had all gone the same route once they moved on that ground, I wouldn't move on the ground. And, you know, keep myself and my family safe. But what I found interesting about this family is that despite the fact that they can go grandfather, father, son, and now grandson, all on the property, all going through the same things, going to jail for abuse and sexual molestation, stuff like that, it seems as though that property draws the family. So when somebody loses it because they've gone to jail or what have you, immediately another member of the family buys it and moves on to that property because that's the family property and they can't let it get out of the family. And I asked somebody once, why? And they looked at me like I'd gone insane. And I said, no, seriously, why? If I knew that everybody in my family that lived here had been in pain and had changed personalities completely and were just not, you know, it was miserable, why would you buy a place where everybody is miserable? And they're like, I don't know. I just feel compelled that I have to hold on to it.
It's kind of like the idea with Amityville, right? You would have thought that, all right, you know, there was Indian wars that took place there. There was some negativity. There's talk of cursed land. You've certainly got the DeFeo family who died horrifically by the hands of Ronnie Butch DeFeo. Then the Lutz family moves in, and they're moved in and moved out in 28 days and leave everything behind them, having this kind of horrible thing. But then nobody's ever reported anything since then. So it's interesting how a curse can be so powerful in a location and then seem to evade everybody else.
I think part of it's energy, but I will say that I knew George Lutz. He was not my best buddy, but I knew him and I had met him several times and I knew other particulars of that case. And I will say that there were things going on in that house that didn't make it into the book and the TV shows and all that stuff right up front. They were into transcendental meditation and calling spirits and what have you. And I think that very possibly they drew it into them because they were so interested in opening themselves up that they made it stronger and gave it the energy to manifest much more strongly than it would for anybody else.
Right, and we've talked about that with Christopher Lutz, Christopher Quarantino, the youngest boy from the family, that there was something like that brought on. But you still think, you know, I mean, there was such tragedy that took place there before the DeFeos, and then the Lutzes, but then it's all gone away. It just seems weird. That seems like a place that would be ripe with some kind of metaphysical scar, whether George and his family brought it in there or not, and the DeFeo family brought it in, and the Indian Wars brought it in. It just seems like that place would have remained crazy. So I understand why people question different aspects of the paranormal, because it doesn't seem logical. But like you said, you know, if it's more attached to the people than it is to the location, that can have a definite aspect of it as well. And do you find many family lines that are what you would believe to honestly be cursed as you do this research?
Well, of course, there's some famous ones. There's the Kennedy family where there supposedly is a curse and has been a curse for many, many generations, that the strongest and the brightest of their young men will always die young. And that's an old, old story. I will tell you, I believe that there's more haunted families than there are cursed families. I've seen a lot of that. In fact, I have a little bit of that in my own family.
Oh, really? Please. Would you mind enlightening us a little bit about that?
Sure. We called him the Zoot Suit Man, and I actually talked about him for the very first time in Kirsten, Pennsylvania. When I was growing up, my mother she was a missionary, and she never talked about spooky stuff, and it was not a very popular topic in my mother's home. So I didn't know much about it, but when I was about 19 years old, we moved into a house. It was an old farmhouse outside of a town I grew up in, and I started having these horrible, horrible nightmares, and it was the same nightmare every single night. I would be going down the stairs. It was a boxed-in staircase to go to the basement to fix the fire in the wood stove, and when I got back up the stairs, I would feel like somebody was watching me from the foot of the steps. I would turn around, and I would look down there, and I will never forget this face as long as I live. I would see a man standing at the bottom of the steps. He had a half cape on. He had a large slouch-brimmed hat, and his head was down, so all you could see was the crown of the hat. His one hand was in his pocket, and he had a gold watch chain and fob. And it looked like I learned out later it was a zoot suit. It was a blue and white pinstripe zoot suit on him. And he would slowly raise his face, and when I could see his face, it was horrifying. He had blonde hair, and you knew in your heart that at one point he had been very, very beautiful, but now all you could see was rotted skin, and it was just awful, and his eyes glowed red. He grinned at me, and I took off down the hall in my nightmare. I'd get in my bedroom. We had a deadbolt lock on the door. I'd slam the lock shut, standing there in the dark, and I'd turn around, and there he was. He'd have a knife in his hand, and I would always wake up screaming when the knife would hit my left shoulder, in between the shoulder, the little hollow of the shoulder there. And I would feel the pain, and I would come flying up out of bed screaming. And this went on for weeks and weeks and weeks. And finally, one day, I said to my sister, who was 4.5 years younger than me, "Have you ever had any nightmares in this house?" And she said, "You mean about the guy in the funny suit?" And I'm like, "What guy in a funny suit?" And so she begins to tell me her version of the dream. And the upshot of the story is, in her version, she sees him as a doctor. And there's a little boy laying in a bed in her room. And at first she thinks she's sort of standing in the background watching. She thinks this man's coming in to help the little boy. And all she can see is like a silhouette and the side of him. And he goes over, and then he starts to kill the little boy. And when she screams and he turns around and grins at her, he's the exact same person. Rotted face, blonde hair, watch fob, the whole nine yards. So finally I said to her, I said, "Oh my God, I think you and I are dreaming about the same guy." And I said, "We're going to have to tell mom." So when my mom came home, we told her about it, and she poo-pooed it. And she's like, "This is what happens when you read too many ghost stories, Patty, blah, blah, blah." And she kind of blows the whole thing over. And then about an hour later, she says to me, "Get a set of sheets and come up to my room. You're going to help me make the bed," which I had never helped her make the bed since I had, grown up. And I go get the sheets, though, and I go upstairs, and she shuts the door, and she says, "I need to talk to you." And I'm like, "Why?" She says, "Did I ever tell you about whenever I decided to become a missionary?" And I said, "No." And she was 17 years old. She was kind of on again, off again about, that kind of a commitment in her life. She volunteered to watch some children at a local house overnight for a couple nights for the family while they had to travel for a funeral or something. And the old houses in central Pennsylvania, I don't know if they're this way other places, but a lot of the old houses have bedrooms where you have to go through one bedroom to get into the second bedroom. It's usually a big bedroom then a little bedroom. And she was sleeping in the inner little bedroom, and she startled awake with what she thought was fire. And her first thought was, "Oh my gosh, the house is on fire." She could see the flickering. And she sat up, and standing at the foot of the bed was the same figure that Georgie and I, my sister and I, had seen. And he stood there and he said, "You're not going to be a missionary. I won't let you." And she started to pray and cry. And he just sort of circled her the bed talking to her, telling her that she was stupid and she was foolish and she was not strong enough to be a missionary. Going on, and she said, I could smell the burning, but there was nothing on fire. And this went on for several minutes, and finally he yelled at her and told her to shut up because she just kept praying and praying. Shut up. And the final thing he said to her is, if I don't get you, I'll go through your children. And she had never told anybody this story in all those years because it scared her so bad. And then he had disappeared, and she jumped out of bed, checked on the children, and then locked herself in the room with the boys that she was babysitting and wouldn't sleep in that room again the whole time she was there. And when I described the figure that my sister and I were seeing, it was the figure she had seen at the foot of her bed 30 years earlier.
That's creepy. You officially gave me goosebumps during that talk. What a freaky, deaky creature this was to begin with. Any idea what you guys were up against?
I honestly believe it was a demonic. And I will tell you, my sons, two of my sons have seen it as well.
No.
I have my oldest son, when he was 13, began to get really freaked out about sleeping in his bedroom. It's a brand new house. We built it. And he would pile pillows up all around him. Like, all of a sudden, all the pillows were disappearing out of the house, and they were all in his room. And I'm like, okay, Dan, you got to give me back pillows. We all need pillows. And one night, he said to me, I'd find him sleeping on my floor. I'd find him in the kitchen on the floor. And he finally told me that this figure with the rotting face and the funny hat and the rain cape, and he had a gold watch chain, Mom, and he would walk around the bed. And he said, the crazy thing is, Mom, he walks through the wall to go all the way around the bed and just circles me and pokes at me and pokes at me and grins. Well, my ex-husband, his father, thought I was crazy. When we first split up, my oldest son decided to stay with his dad. And one night they're kind of arguing back and forth. There's a lot of stress in the house and they're arguing. And my oldest son goes into the bathroom. He's 14 at the time. He comes out. He goes across the hall to his bedroom. His shadow goes with him. A second shadow peeled off the wall wearing a hat and a half cape. You could see the silhouette. And it followed him into the bedroom. That night, I got a phone call from my ex-husband. He said, you got to drive back down here and get him. Get Danny, get him out of here now. And I'm like, why? He said, I'm not going to tell you if you get down here. This was not a happy, amicable relationship. I was really scared, but I was more scared something was happening to Dan. At 1 o'clock in the morning, I pulled into their driveway and they both met me. And he admitted, my ex-husband admitted for the first time, I saw the thing. I saw the damn thing you saw.
No kidding. So even in this comfortable relationship you two were sharing, he was willing to admit that this was real.
It scared him so badly, he admitted it. He finally admitted it. And Daniel came to stay with me and then eventually went to stay with my mom for a couple months because he was so scared. He was afraid to sleep anywhere else except he literally slept on my mom's floor. He was a 14-year-old boy sleeping on his grandmother's floor beside her because he was afraid to not do it because when he was away from her and I, the thing would circle him. And then my little boy had nightmares, really bad nightmares. And we went to Gettysburg, and there's a ghost in the Cashtown Inn who is particularly fond of us. And he literally said to this ghost, his nickname is Sarge, while he was staying there, he said, please don't let the thing come and get me while I'm here. And he said every night he dreamt that while we were there, that Sarge was at the foot of his bed, and he said, I could see the thing in the distance, Mom, but it wouldn't come near Sarge. And after that, for some reason, it left him alone. Now, my youngest has never said anything, but I do believe whatever this is has tried to fulfill its promise. If it couldn't go through my mom, it would come through her kids.
You would think that, you know, especially being a missionary, there'd be some general protection that would be afforded to you and her family. Why do you think that this being is with you? Do you think maybe it's something that has been with the family before this lifetime as well?
I don't know about before that. And my grandma never talked about it, and she would tell stories because she was sensitive. But honestly, being a missionary or being religious or being spiritual doesn't give you special protection. It puts a bounty on your head. more than anything, because the devil doesn't mess with what he already has. He only wants to go after what he doesn't.
That's a hell of a story. What are you doing now to try to protect you and your family? Is there anything that you found that works to stave this thing off?
Prayer, faith. I mean, if I haven't seen it in a lot of years, I know it's always out there. I work some demonic cases, but I will tell you that I have more faith than probably anybody you'll ever meet, because I truly believe that without God, that thing would have sway in my life. And I'm not like super religious, go to church every Sunday, but faith, prayer, talking to God daily, every day of my life. And I know that I couldn't keep it away if it wouldn't be that God was helping me.
Well, that's a good cheery way to leave the show here, Patty. Leave everybody with some chills up and down their backs for the evening. If any of our listeners have encountered this being, please email me. I'd love to hear what happened to you, and I'll pass those stories on to Patty as well. We wish you a lot of success with the new book, Cursed in the Carolinas, Stories of the Damned. Do you promise you'll come back with us when you have another book?
I absolutely do promise, and I actually have two books on the way, so I'll look forward to it.
Excellent. What can we expect next? What will the next two books be about?
Well, the first one, and it's going to sound silly, but in the title I chose to be provocative. It's called Paranormal Porn, but it's about sex and the paranormal in every facet, from people who court having sex with the dead to people who are physically attacked by incubus and succubus and what have you. And it came about because I was interviewing a woman who had been sexually attacked by a demonic prior to John Zaffis doing a series of exorcisms. And her story was so poignant of how hopeless she was and how helpless she was and how she almost had herself committed to an insane asylum before the spunk inside of her kicked in. And she said, "Not crazy. I'm not crazy. I've seen the bruises and what have you. You know, I know that I'm not imagining this." And she went back and she started looking, and she found a friend of mine, Scott Morrow. And through Scott, she made contact with John Zaffis, who then went to Philadelphia and performed a couple exorcisms, which ended up saving her. And when I was doing the interviews with this woman, I could hear the fear, the pain, and the helplessness that was in her voice. And that's what sort of spurred me on to start to look at this field, because it's the part of the paranormal we don't talk about or we laugh about it. But you know what? For some people, it's deadly real.
Yeah, you had me at porn. that's going to be definitely a provocative title. And what's the second book you're working on?
It's called The Vanished, and it's about people that just mysteriously disappear for no good reason. You know, for example, one of the stories is about a young man in Erie in the 1990s who came back from military boot camp, had dinner with five of his friends, all five of them piled into the car with him. He asked if he could drop them off at a party. They dropped him off at the party, and they watched him going up the stairs. You could see that there's, you know, a lot of people, lights, music, what have you. It's a party. Walks past people on the steps, talks to them. They see him get a hold of the door to go inside. They pull out. And the next day, his mother calls one of them and says, "Have you seen him?" And they're like, "No, we haven't seen him at all. He was at the party." So eventually, nobody inside the party saw him, but everybody saw him get out of the car. Everybody saw him cross the porch, open the door, and then he was gone.
And just gone.
Gone.
That's unbelievable. Well, we're looking forward to both of those, so please let me know when those are out and available, and we look forward to talking to you at that time. Again, we'll have a link up. The book is Cursed in the Carolinas, Stories of the Damned. Patty Wilson, our guest. And remember, you've got to go try out the brand new Podcast One app. It is easier to use than ever. I love this app. We've been offering it to our listeners for a while. They got it. There was some bugs. They tweaked. They got it all right. It is now working fantastic. If you have not tried it, you can get it for both your iPhone and any Droid or smartphone devices. Just go download the free app for Podcast One, and you'll be able to keep up with the show that way. And I know you're going to absolutely love all the new changes. It's made it so much easier to use, follow, and to kind of bunch your stories, your shows, all the things that you love to do, and keep up with it. Plus, there's workable environments within it. So go check that out and make sure that you get your updated version of the Podcast One app. If you ever have problems with any of the shows and things are lagging or staggering, make sure you always go in and update to make sure you've got the most current and up-to-date versions of the software, because that's what often will happen as things start to stagger and act weird. It's because you haven't updated recently. So make sure you do that. And that's it for tonight. We'll be back again tomorrow with Phantoms and Fingerprints here on the Best in Paranormal Talk Radio. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Beyond the Darkness.
Chances are you've been to the doctor recently, and you probably handed over your insurance, your ID, and even your social security number. Your doctor is just one of many places that has your personal info. And if any of them accidentally expose your details, you could be at risk for identity theft. LifeLock monitors millions of data points a second. If you become a victim, they'll fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART, or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.